Yeah, it's exactly 7 o'clock here in South Africa. I'm Alec Hogg, and here's your Biz News Briefing. Cracking show coming up, and welcome back to South Africa, David Shapiro, who's going to be taking us through some insights on the market. Dave, you're a world traveler. It's nothing unusual for you, but lovely to be home, I'm sure.
Yes, it is. It's always, especially now that we're going into summer, just having come out of the US where they're going into fall or autumn, as they say, it's starting to get colder, but also nice and relaxed to be here. Yeah. And trying to catch up, Alec. Quick catch-up course on what's been happening here. You know, I've been just subjected to election, and all other issues that are happening in America at the moment.
Well, sadly, I'm going to give you a little bit more of election as we pick up with the news headlines from our partners at Bloomberg. Here's the latest from Bloomberg Now.
The U.S. is reportedly investigating the leak of top-secret American documents showing Israeli military preparations for an expected strike on Iran. The Wall Street Journal reports the two leaked reports were prepared last week by the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Neither document indicates Israel's potential targets. Now, one report cautioned that analysts at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency cannot definitely predict the scale and scope of a strike on Iran. The reports describe the types of aircraft and munitions the Israeli military is expected to use in an attack, which the documents say could come without additional warning. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu held a series of meetings over the weekend with top security aides to discuss the next attack on Iran. Now, these meetings came a day after a Hezbollah drone penetrated Israeli defense forces and exploded near the private home of Netanyahu north of Tel Aviv. Needless to say, the attack stunned many Israelis. I spoke earlier with Bloomberg's John J. Edwards, Weekend America's managing editor, and I asked whether this raises the stakes for some type of retaliation against Iran.
It definitely furthers Israel's resolve to respond in some kind of way that will be seen as firm and proportional, but sending a message to Iran that it and its proxies, hopefully from Israel's point of view, will see this response and decide to go in a different direction.
That's John J. Edwards, Bloomberg Weekend America's managing editor. In the week ahead, we'll be listening for comments from a number of Fed officials, and we'll be watching for a report on nationwide manufacturing. Bloomberg's Karen Moscow has a preview.
Monday, the IMF and World Bank hold their annual meetings in Washington. We'll also be hearing from some regional Fed presidents, including Dallas's Lori Logan, Kansas City's Jeffrey Schmid, and Minneapolis's Neel Kashkari, and we get a report on leading economic indicators. Wednesday is existing home sales, new home sales, weekly jobless claims, and S&P Global Manufacturing and Services PMI are all out on Thursday. And Friday, it's durable goods orders and consumer sentiment. Karen Moscow, Bloomberg Radio.
And we'll get a parade of earnings as well, with a number of high-profile companies reporting, including several Dow members. Here's a preview from Bloomberg's Charlie Pellett.
We'll be getting earnings reports this week from AT&T, Boeing, and Coca-Cola amid questions about whether the outlook for corporate profits justifies current valuations. Quincy Crosby is chief global strategist at LPL Financial.
This is a market that really is discerning and will punish any slight hint in the guidance that doesn't meet ultimately the valuations.
Also reporting this week, GE, Tesla, American Airlines, and Southwest Airlines. We'll also hear from UPS and Norfolk Southern. In New York, Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
The U.S. is reportedly
So, David, there's a heck of a lot of reporting coming through this week.
Listening.
It's amazing, isn't it, that we are in the middle of this U.S. reporting season, and it's actually so important to us here in South Africa.
Oh, yeah. Look, Alec, I did a lot of soul searching and, where should we be? What should we do? But what really captured me, talking to people, remember, I was there for the Jewish holiday. So I met a lot of people. We were there at Seder's and, big crowds and talking to them and getting a feel for what they're doing and, what their sentiments are. And particularly where it comes to the election, we can talk about that. But generally, I I find the U.S. still pumping. I think that it just remains an incredibly dynamic economy, you know, and it's the competition amongst these people that just kind of keeps businesses on their toes. You know, you can't slacken. If you're in America and you're running a business, and I think that's what makes it dynamic, and that's why you can't ignore it. You know, and it creates a very high benchmark for everybody else. And I think America is still growing pretty reasonably. I think they're the only economy that is above where it was kind of pre-COVID. So that's why I'm saying it's very important. And the companies that you mentioned, the companies that were mentioned in the headlines, are still very much part of our lives here, you know, in South Africa. So we have to keep an eye on what the economy is doing. You know, India's big, China's big, but in terms of population, in terms of GDP per capita, they can't match the output of you know, of America. So it's very important for us, you know, to keep an eye on what's happening there.
Yeah, no, we're close. 26%, the United States is still by far the dominant. But Dave, I think you're going to enjoy this. It's from this morning's FT News briefing talking about a South African, or at least we claim him anyway. He was born and raised in Pretoria, Elon Musk, who is hitting the headlines all over the place because of his impact on the US election, or potential impact on the US election. Let's listen to, we'll pick up with Kasia Brasalian.
And finally, let's talk about Elon Musk.
I have a surprise for you.
Over the weekend, the billionaire entrepreneur gave out a $1 million check to someone at a rally in Pennsylvania. Musk was campaigning for Donald Trump.
By the way, John had no idea. So anyway, you're welcome.
It's part of this Oprah-like giveaway to registered voters in swing states. They need to sign his political action committee's petition on free speech and gun rights.
Yeah, so I think this is kind of fun. And it seems like a good use of money, basically.
But legal scholars say the raffle might violate U.S. election rules. Federal law states that you can't offer financial incentives to vote. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, who's a Democrat, said on Sunday that the move was something, quote, law enforcement can take a look at.
Elon Musk, David. Yeah. He's just on it, isn't he?
All over. And you have to think of his motives. You know, this is why has he come out so wildly in favor of Trump? You know, number Trump, first of all, Trump's favorite word, as we know, is tariff, you know, tariffs. And, of course, that favors Tesla because his biggest fear of the Chinese competitors with EV. And then he needs government as well. So he's taking a big bet on Trump coming in. I don't know what happens if Trump doesn't come in, because I'm not sure Kamala will be, you know, warm to Elon if she manages to cross the line. But I think there's a lot of business motivation behind, you know, what he's doing, the fact that he's coming out so much in favor. But why Pennsylvania, Alec? I think it just comes down to those swing states. You know, it's a nation divided. And I think it's those seven odd swing states that are going to decide who becomes the next president. So it's very important with Pennsylvania, you know, where he is, where he gave their money away. One of the most important of those, you know, of those states.
It's extraordinary how it's coming down to that. It's on a knife edge. We have a piece on BizNews this morning from our partners at the Financial Times, where there was an interview with Musk who says, well, basically, if Donald Trump loses, I'm F beep, beep, beep. So he knows exactly what he's doing. We're going to talk to Sai this week. Sai Jacobs, you know Sai from 361.
Of course I know Sai.
At the last BizNews conference, he said his big short, in other words, the stock that he thinks is going to fall the most, is Tesla. So he's going to talk to us when the Tesla results are out. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's such a groundswell behind Elon. Sai going short is playing a game. A dangerous game, maybe.
Very much so. It's there's certain stocks that you don't go short, because this can swing around. This can turn very, very fast. And look, he's a character. I mean, he's incredibly, well, I don't want to say a popular figure, but, you know, everybody knows Elon. I must say that from an election point of view, I think most people are absolutely exhausted by Trump. You know, this is the third election that he's contesting. So you've had him from 2016, you know, with all these outrageous claims, his lies, corruption, and so on. And it's just interesting to get people's opinion on where they're voting. And I think if they vote for Kamala, she's not popular. Hey? She's not popular at all. But I think she's an antidote, you know, against Trump and that. And she's an honest kind of person. You know, she doesn't go crazy or she doesn't cozy up to Putin or other dictators. So they see her as just something on the other side that will bring a bit of calmness to America. But a lot to talk about there and a lot to watch. And it's soon. You know, this is coming very, very soon.
Yeah. 5th of November, is it? Just a couple of weeks from now.
Sure.
David, ASML, you were in the US. So yes. I didn't have the chance to talk to you. We've been following it last week. The market did not like the financial results from the company. It's in our portfolio, in lots of the portfolios of your clients as well. Are you seeing through it and perhaps seeing this as a buying opportunity?
I think so. You know, I'm not one who's – I don't like my ego to get in the way. But this is a superb business. You know, it's the quality of the machines it's make is uncontested. It's a monopoly. There are not many businesses. And I think what I didn't realize and what caught us by surprise was, number one, the China story, you know, how that's affecting them. And also the slowdown in demand for chips, you know, that are not AI related. But I think if you listen to management, it will pick up. We might have to wait a bit, but I think at these levels, it's at a very attractive metrics, you know, very attractive PE. And if there was something structurally wrong with the company, yes, I'd abandon it and say, okay, look for something else. But I think it's still a pivotal part in the manufacture of chips, you know. And I think things, Alec, I think we're going into a very good period. You know, I know, is it going to be another 25 points or not a 25-point rate cut, whatever it is, we are going to see ongoing rate cuts. We are going to see growth picking up, maybe not at the pace we want, but still in the right direction. And I think within time, the chips outside of AI, that sector will recover. And AI still remains a very big driving force of this market. So, yeah, it punished me. It's one of those results when it comes down, it was like just watching the football results over the weekend. You just sit there and say, please don't talk to me. You know, just leave me a bit to, you know, to absorb this, to digest this, you know. So, I must admit, I sulked a lot when ASML's results came out. But I'm staying with it. You know, it's been a very good performer over time. I think performance will pick up again.
That's what investing's about. You understand the basis of your decision to buy into the shares. And when you do get a pullback, like this one is over 20%, then it is, if you still believe in the story, then it's still, as the long-term story, then it's a buying opportunity. But David, more broadly in the United States, we know, and there have been ad nauseum reports coming out to say that the performance of the S&P 500 and the Dow have been because of a handful of big companies. They used to call it the Magnificent Seven. I'm not sure what they call them now, but there's all kinds of monikers that they give it. But if one looks across broadly across the American economy, which is doing well, lower interest rates are going to help all companies, small and medium caps. That's the place we've put a bet on in the BizNews portfolio through the Russell 2000. Do you like that?
You're right. You're absolutely right. You know, it is going to happen. The problem is that, and I think doing what you're doing is the only way to play it through an index. Because when I break down the Russell 2000, you know, the 2000 shares, it's very difficult to say, give me a couple of winners. So I think that from that point of view, you're right. You know, those companies that have lagged the Magnificent Seven and all those AI-related stocks are going to benefit. And I think it's the same here. You know, when you look at the JSE and you break it down, you break down the JSE's performance, There has, you know, other than NASPERS and Process, which is benefiting significantly from the recovery in Tencent, but there've been some incredible performers in the small and medium cap area. And don't try to pick the winners out of the Russell 2000. Just take the index. I'm not a great index follower, but I think in this case, your bet is absolutely right.
And South African small and medium caps, would you go with someone like Piet Viljoen, who's been focusing his fund there, or would you be able to pick some eyes out?
No. I'm going with Piet and focusing on some of the smaller businesses that are just, you know, superbly run. You can't get liquidity. That's the difficulty with some of those businesses. But, you know, if you look at an OUTsurance, you look at the Bidcores, the Bidvest, the Afrimats of this world and so on, I'm just, you know, randomly mentioning businesses and that. They're very, very well run. And our banks, Sanlam, I like where Sanlam's going. So I think you've got to be very picky. You know, you can't go at the top end of the market with a British American Tobacco or AB InBev or even some of the miners are still lagging a lot. You know, we've still got to – yes, China's doing a lot. You know, China came out this morning again with another stimulus measure. I think they're going to be slow, and one day they're all going to be stick together and we're going to suddenly see, recovery in our commodity markets. But I think the cherry picking in South African market is the way you're going to make money, and you'll do very well. The economy will recover; it will pick off that low base. And Alec, I have to mention when I came back and I saw the number of people flying into South Africa, there's not a flight that is not packed. The lines now to get through security are enormous. And as I was saying before we went on air, we better be prepared for a very big holiday season.
David Shapiro, South Africa's favorite stockbroker, bringing to a close this part of the program. We've still got coming up some very interesting insights for you, starting off in a moment with Piet Leroux. And this is all about BEE in agriculture. It was the front page lead on Rapport newspaper yesterday. And John Steenhuisen is being urged to remove BEE legislations from the agricultural sector, which, as you would have heard last week from a number of our contributors, is one area of the South African economy that really is flying. But before we get there, here's Neil De Beer. Now, he and my colleague Chris Dane have got a wonderful program on a Sunday afternoon where they sit together, chat for about 20 minutes or so, and Neil just doesn't hold back. He talks about it in the way he sees it. He is the president of the UIM, a political party, didn't get quite enough votes to get into parliament this time around, but his popularity of his podcast and YouTube videos with Chris suggests he's got lots more votes coming next time around. People love the direct approach that he has. And here's a little snippet from their conversation yesterday that I think in the context of discussing Piet Leroux, you'll find very interesting. It's the latest appointment in the Agriculture Minister John Steenhuisen's office.
In a lighter moment, Democratic Alliance leader John Steenhuisen has appointed Big Daddy Liberty to his office. Neil, isn't he still trying to get rid of the previous web celeb he appointed?
I think this is a new era that bloggers are great parliamentarians, that bloggers and vloggers and social media people have got this immense attraction on standing on the boxes of political parties and say what they want to say, but this time it's a different arena. So this is not the first time that we are seeing now within the DA that social media personalities like Sihle Ngobese, Big Daddy Liberty, but not the first. We've had Ronaldo Gous, we've had Kavanagh. We've had also a young guy called Liam Jacobs, Mr. Ding Dong Dilly Dong. We've got four people in the DA that are known socialites on social media, all of them thrust in a political arena. And I'm trying to make sense of it by saying, is this the new era that we are moving into? And I'm afraid to say, up till now, if you look at the four that the DA has put in, with a new gentleman, Big Daddy, you've now got two in and you've got two out. Well, the one is not wanting to go, by the way. Mr. Kavanagh is refusing to leave, and rumor is he's still pondering the slippery slopes of John's office. So is this a good thing? Chris, I think the dynamics of politics have changed in the sense that three quarters of political battle is fought on TikTok, is fought on vlogs and blogs. But does that give the person who is put in that position the experience, the knowledge? The jury is out, and it doesn't seem at this moment that it's 100%. We will have to watch the space. I actually have connected many times with Sihle. He is a graduate. He is a person that I must tell you, out of all of them, has a lot of insight. I like him. I have a huge respect for the way that he addresses things, not his politics in all. So let's see. I mean, but John reaching out, it seems, to the social media space to do what? I think we will need to watch that closely.
We'll hear from Neil De Beer again right at the end of the program with a little tail piece, and I'm sure it's well worth holding on for, as is this conversation with Piet Leroux, who is the chief executive of Saka Liga. Piet, you guys were on the front page of a report yesterday, and this after you are now urging or putting pressure on it at the very least on the new agriculture minister, John Steenhuisen, to withdraw BEE plans for agricultural imports and exports. Just in a nutshell, tell us what it is that's irritating you so.
Alec, I just missed you for a second there, but if you ask in a nutshell, what is it all about?
Well, yeah. Why are you so angry? Okay.
Well, we're not that angry. We're pretty calm. We just let John know in a letter, verbally, that the Agri-BEE regulations published by his Director General, Muketsa Ramasori, is not acceptable. And they are not John Steenhuisen's innovation. They predate his term as minister, but they are nevertheless still unacceptable. And John has informed us that he was not aware of the regulations now published by his DG, and he's asked his DG for a briefing. So we'll see about that. But we find it unacceptable that exports and import quotas are made subject to BEE criteria. And this is now applied to import and exports to the UK and Ireland and the European Union, also to imports from World Trade Organization countries. And this concerns a certain minority, but nevertheless meaningful minority of agricultural imports and exports, up to 200 million liters of wine, up to 500,000 tons of agricultural produce. And it's not about permission. Absolutely about exporting and importing, but about the reduced duty tariffs. So you're effectively putting penalties on non-BEE farmers.
Why do you call it penalties? Clearly there is a group that is wanting to incentivize farmers to get more BEE in their operations. And this looks like they're incentivizing them by reducing tariffs, not necessarily increasing tariffs for those who don't have it.
No, what is happening is it's an abuse of the international trade agreements under the World Trade Organization Marrakesh Agreement and the EU Economic Partnership Agreements with the EU and with the UK and Northern Ireland. And these agreements have been in place for several years, and the purpose is to reduce barriers to trade by reducing the import and export tariffs for trade between these countries. And there's no intention in these treaties for the one country to impose additional criteria and abuse its administrative obligations. To abuse its administrative obligations. And so what is happening is that the what is happening is that this abuse is now continuing, and I'm calling it a penalty because that is what it is. It is forcing farmers who don't do BEE to pay, let's say, I think it's about R3 extra per bottle of wine of exports. And on 200 million litres of wine, if those were all in bottles, that would be something like several hundred million rand of penalties on farmers who don't do BEE. Okay, that's why I call it a penalty. You can call it an incentive, yeah. But The government is making the one kind of person pay for this and favoring another and abusing a treaty, a trade agreement for it.
I guess the thing that really does or has to be concerning people is that these ideas were promulgated on the 3rd and the 4th and the 7th of October. So this month, this is well into the government of national unity. And they were promulgated by the Director General. And we've heard a lot about the GNU being great, that we can go forward, the politicians are talking to each other. But if the ministers and the directors general are on different pages, which could be very possible if they're DA ministers, that might be papering over a crack that could, well, could hurt us in time. Are you seeing it that way?
Yeah, well, that is what Mr. Steenhuisen has informed us, that he was not aware of this and that he was circumspect in what he said in his letter to us, but he seems to find this unacceptable, the reissuance of these regulations. So we'll have to see how he deals with it. But, but Alec, this is completely to be expected. There are several million employees in this government and parastatal environment, and they have not changed with the change of ministers. Just in Johannesburg alone, for example, I think there's something like 70,000 employees on the municipality's books. So changing the conduct of this machine called the state by changing a few senior positions is absolutely unlikely to result in significant improvements in the short run. The ministers in this new government they must try their best, but we must be circumspect in our expectations of how much can be achieved. Between ministers who, now this DG in agriculture, he was part of the design of these regulations from the beginning. He was part of the guard that installed this. And it's unlikely that just because his minister changed, him and his whole department will suddenly stop doing these unlawful things and stop believing in BEE as a solution to problems in South Africa. I think they're as convinced as ever of what they're doing, and there's going to be a big tension between these new ministers and their DGs and their staff. And I think it's that's, you called our letter, well, why are we angry? I think our letter is just firm, and we have to say it like it is. And we will apply the pressure at the appropriate point, which is the minister, and we must ask him to do something about it. And depending on his actions, we will either express our approval or continue with further steps.
Who has the power here?
The initiative certainly this time seems to have been in the hands of the DG. We've asked the minister to have these regulations retracted. We'll have to see. I think maybe a few weeks from now, a month or two or three, maybe we'll know who had the power. At this stage, on paper, it's the minister. We'll have to see. Alec, I could add that these regulations are in step with official plans in the department called their Agri-BEE plan and their Agri-BEE enforcement guidelines. These have been in existence for between 8 and 5 years now. And they were developed under Toko Didiza and even her predecessor. And we exposed these last year after we were able to obtain them through a PIA request. But they were confidential and hidden within the department. They were not published on the department's website, even though they were documents of public interest. And these plans, we released and they're available. The links on our website, the links are there in our letter to John Steenhuisen. These plans are very explicit that it is the intention of the department to make all permits for import and export, or licenses like water licenses, all phytosanitary so-called services that government deliver, every interaction of government with agricultural sector, import or export or production in South Africa. They want to make every aspect of it subject to BEE criteria, initially just as a penalization, and with time or in time as an absolute criteria for allowing or disallowing. And this is explicit in their plans. I'm not saying what I think they're meaning. I'm saying what they are saying. And these plans are also still in place. So our letter to John says, look, Minister Steenhuisen, these recent regulations, we object to them and we will be taking steps. But we invite you to just take them back or meet with us, because the larger problem here is that your government, your ministry's official plans are still in place, and we actually require the plans as well to be withdrawn. And so I think John Steenhuisen, it's a bit of a tough challenge we've put to him, but it is the appropriate challenge. And we must make use of this opportunity of a DA minister to see whether BEE is going to stay in place or not. And I think this is what we'll see in the next few months.
Is it not putting the whole government of national unity at risk? Let's think this one through. There is a National Democratic Revolution program, as we've heard from Anthea Jeffrey at the IRR on numerous occasions. He's even written a book on it. That's in place. But that, to be implemented, needs to have thumbs up now from not just the ANC, but by its partner, which is in this case the Democratic Alliance. Isn't there what you're doing is kind of forcing the point, which may be a little early for in their trust building relationship, or do you not see it that way?
No, Alec, I think we must be careful of hoping for the best within a black box, and we must just wait for magic happening within a black box and sit on the outside and accept whatever comes out. It's appropriate to require of ministries and of government, whether it is with the DA inside or not, whether it's with the IFP inside or not, whether it's with the Freedom Front inside or not, it is appropriate to require lawful action, to require appropriate government, to require not making participation in the economy subject to race criteria. Maybe someone would argue, well, Minister Steenhuisen should keep BEE in place or some measure of it because he has no choice. Well, then he must do that. And then that will enable us, as Saakeliga, it'll enable you and your listeners and enable the whole of society to understand what the rules of the game are here. If the government of national unity means BEE stay in place, well, then let's know that. From our side, we're treating this government the same as we're treating other governments. And just because it's called a government of national unity does not change what we expect of from this government versus another government. And so we're not angry about it, but we do want to know what's up.
In other words, hope is not a strategy. Give me the facts.
Yes, yeah. And so let's determine the facts, yeah.
Piet Leroux is the chief executive of the Saakeliga, which is a very powerful voice for business, and raising an issue here which I think the optimists about the government of national unity are not too happy to hear, but it is a process. We're 100 days in. Now there's an issue, the very first issue, this one, of great severity within a department. We've seen the DA getting unhappy about the Bella Bill on education, but that can go to court, so that can be fought there. This one is within a department of a DA minister, and, well, in this case, the DA leader on top of it, where he's clearly been sidelined in legislation by his director general. We'll have to see how that all works out. I would recommend that you also pick up on the Neil De Beer interview to get some insight into the way he's reading this and a lot of the little things that are suddenly being put into the back burner or onto the back burner because we have a government of national unity. And Neil is arguing that, no, that's not the way to run a country. It'd be interesting to me because both Neil and the deputy president of the country, Paul Mashatile, will be at the Biz News conference next March. That's in Hermanus again. It'll be our seventh conference, the annual conference there. And we will be releasing the bookings information later this week. But I guess that what people say publicly can sometimes be miscommunicated, and perhaps you need to just get everybody into a room and sort those things out. Well, there's no miscommunication in the next story. And by the way, we are going to talk in just a moment about the Freedom Index, and we've got Michael Jordaan coming up later as well. So lots still to come in the Biz News briefing today. But this comes from our partners at the Financial Times, and the FT news briefing this morning talks about a very big development which is relevant for South Africa. South Africa has got plenty of gas and oil reserves off the Cape Coast, but they are not being developed. First of all, it was because of really poor legislation, thanks Jacob Zuma. Now that the legislation is being reassessed, there is unfortunately still some problems within the government structures where we did see that the oil operation in the old Mosgas did not want to give an offtake agreement with Total, so Total pulled out of a very attractive oil find off Mossel Bay. That's part of the story. But who's going to fund the investments into oil and gas in the future when the Western world is all ESG'd focused? Here's the FT with a very interesting story on how that development is going to change in Africa and indeed affect us here.
A group of African countries is looking for billions of dollars to help launch an energy bank next year, but maybe not the kind that's good for the environment. It wants a lender to support fossil fuel projects. A lot of Western institutions are starting to step back from those because, well, as you can imagine, fossil fuels aren't really in vogue anymore. Here to give me the scoop on the initiative is my colleague Anu Adeoye. Hey, Anu.
Hi.
So tell me a little bit more about this coalition and what type of projects it's hoping to fund.
This coalition is called the African Petroleum Producers Organization. It consists of 18 African countries who, as the name suggests, are producers of crude oil. So these are regional heavyweights like Nigeria, Libya, Angola. And these countries, together with the African Export and Import Bank, which is a partner in the project, are looking to raise $5 billion to finance primarily fossil fuel projects.
But like I mentioned, Western institutions maybe aren't so down to fund these types of projects anymore. So what are you hearing about this hesitancy from people on the ground?
If you talk to anyone who is in this industry in Africa, they say that funding for fossil fuel projects has not completely dried out, but it is becoming much more difficult to convince Western traditional backers of such projects to put money on the continent. And most of them say that this is because of ESG concerns and, you know, the real fact that the climate is changing and the world is getting warmer. For example, you know, Standard Chartered last year pulled out of a $1 billion deal to finance a pipeline in Uganda that was supposed to carry crude from Uganda to the Tanzanian coast because it had become a target for environmental activists. So, you know, when you talk to people in Africa, there's a sense that funding for fossil fuel projects are starting to become only a trickle.
But, you know, the bigger issue here is that pulling back from fossil fuels, it kind of makes sense, right? We're in the middle of a global climate crisis. So I guess what's the argument from this coalition to keep fossil fuel projects going?
Yeah. One thing that the people behind this coalition always make clear is that they believe in climate change. So this is not a group of, you know, kooky people who don't believe that the world is warming. But what they are saying is that Africa has not contributed that much to climate change, that a lot of developed Western countries, you know, the US, European countries, and, you know, China as well, they have all industrialized using fossil fuel to turbocharge growth in their countries. And what people in this coalition are saying is that because there hasn't been that much of an investment in the green transition in Africa, it should be allowed to develop its fossil fuel projects, because if you stop, you're going to drive more and more people into poverty. So basically their argument is we need to solve what is called energy poverty before we try and think about the green transition.
Anu Adeoye is the FT's West and Central Africa correspondent. Thanks, Anu.
Thank you.
Fascinating story. And geopolitics is really playing a big role at the moment. You might not have recognized it, but the story's on BizNews. We now have 9 countries in BRICS, including Iran, which we spoke about at the top of the hour. Iran at the moment is, well, preparing itself for a strike by the Israelis as a retaliation for the last strike. It's just tit for tat, I suppose, but with deadly consequences. The world is a dangerous place. Neil Emmerich is with the Free Market Foundation, and I guess it's getting more dangerous, Neil. Let's just pick up very... Uh-oh, I've got a quite bad echo coming through here, Neil.
Does that reduce it slightly?
Well, there we go. Not really. All right, I'm just going to have to ask you, because it is, we're getting feedback coming through from when I speak. So I'm actually going to ask you just to give us in a nutshell exactly what the Freedom Index is about and how South Africa's rating.
Yeah, well, good morning. And it's nice to be able to deliver some good news for a change. We come out with a report annually. And this year we're able to report that South Africa has gone up in the rankings instead of down. We've moved from 85th last year to 81, which for the first time in a while has put us in the top half of countries. We measure 165 countries around the world. And this is now, I think, the first time in about 5-6 years that we've gone back into the top half.
So who's around us, just to give some context?
The BRICS countries, funnily enough. I mean, maybe just a little background. The index itself is attempting to measure economic freedom, and how's that defined? So in a broad context, we're looking at whether the individual has choices, economic choices, over, say, the government. If you're taxed 100%, then you're a slave. You know, if tax zero, that's obviously extremely free. So somewhere in the middle is where we're measuring. Different countries score differently in different areas. They've got different histories. South Africa now, as we say, smack bang in the middle. We're a very average country doing average things. But we do have some quirks, which is, you know, areas that we feel we could do better in. To your question, India is 84th. We're 81st. Brazil is 85th, so that we're very much surrounded there by our BRICS fellows. On the African side, Mauritius is 17th, so that's the most free country in Africa. And the next African country is Kenya at 74th, so slightly better than us. Uganda at 76th, and then Botswana is at 80th. So that kind of gives you a feel for where we sit. In terms of overall countries, you could the top 10 is Hong Kong, Singapore, Switzerland, the US, as you'd expect. In the bottom, we've got countries like the Sudan, Zimbabwe, and Venezuela's at the rock bottom. Japan is 11th, Germany is 16th, France is 36th, Italy 51st. So it's that sort of smell test.
So why is this important? What's the impact of being higher up on the economic freedom index on things like economic growth, job creation, etc.?
Well, you know, as an associate of the Free Market Foundation, we're obviously coming at these things from a certain perspective. But the motivation behind this report, which is now 30 years old, is that economic freedom counts, and that the individual's right to choose is an important contribution to freedom more generally. And the important part then is, well, okay, so what follows from there? And that's where this particular report is important, because it forms part of an econometric body of work that says, okay, well, given economic freedom, what comes out of it? And there's a couple of interesting stats they've got in this year's report, which is that if you take the 165 countries, split them up into quartiles, what are the average income levels and so on of the bottom and the top? Now, if economic freedom didn't matter, those numbers would be all over the place, but they're not. They're highly correlated with very good outcomes. The freer you are, the more of everything you tend to have. So the top 40 countries in that list earn $53,000 a year, where the bottom quarter earn $7,000. A very, very important statistic is the poorest 10% in the top 40 countries earn $7,600 a year, where the poor in the unfree countries earn $900 a year. So it really matters where you're going to be poor. The life expectancy is 16 years longer in free countries. Your Environmental health is 50% better. And in fact, there's 2.5% times less corruption. So these are the sort of studies that people have done where economic freedom is the variable on the left side, and then you plot whether these good outcomes fall on the right. And over 1,000 papers now have shown that the freer an economy is, the more likely you are to have better outcomes.
I'd just like to play devil's advocate here, Neil. We've just had a report from the Financial Times, our partners in London, about Africa wanting to exploit its oil and gas reserves, but being prevented from doing so because of funding reasons, as the international banks are following a different agenda, a agenda which appears very hypocritical, given that most of the climate change problems come from the West. And so now, as a consequence of them trying to reduce the carbon emissions, they're not allowing African countries, or not giving African countries, the support that they need to improve climate change. Isn't there something here as well when you have a look at economic freedom, given that the countries who have had the advantages and the benefits in the past and have been able to pollute the atmosphere and perhaps do other things that, looking back, don't look so good in history, they've now got a big advantage and they can afford to have economic freedom, whereas other countries that are still trying to pull themselves up might find a different method of governance to support them. And I'm talking here obviously about China, but India's similar. It's very hard to get a foreign-owned business in going in India, for instance. So, and as you said earlier, they're a little lower than us on the economic freedom index. How do you address a question like that?
Well, it's a tough one, isn't it? I mean, this index is looking at law. So where are there laws in place that restrict individual freedom? And some of what is going on in Europe, especially in terms of climate change, is not so much from law, but as well as just political pressure from the markets. And so in some sense, it's voluntary behavior. Obviously, some of it is legal in the form of the tariffs that they're now putting on carbon produced goods from Africa. Tariffs are never good. I mean, borders are political fences, and you know, the index does show that free trade promotes wealth everywhere. So to the degree Europe is now restricting its imports, it's going to hurt them. I mean, it will hurt us, obviously. We won't be able to trade with them to the same degree. But it's a choice. And, you know, things like climate change, I mean, people will find this statement controversial, but it's almost a luxury good. Once you've achieved a decent level of income and decent levels of education, well, then, you know, some of these environmental issues then come to the fore. But Africa has some bigger problems to solve. I mean, we have some real poverty issues that we wish to solve. So, you know, I'm going to be the free trader. And so, you know, we want to be able to trade. We have excellent resources in gas and oil off our shores. So, you know, the opportunity to exploit those would seem low-hanging fruit.
I presume then, from that philosophical perspective, that you would be hoping that Donald Trump, Mr. Tariffs, does not win the U.S. presidential election. It's a complicated race, but if tariffs were to be introduced, that would surely have an impact on something like the Freedom Index.
It would affect America's freedom score. Obviously, this is something that countries can deal with unilaterally. I mean, nothing stops South Africa from removing all of its tariffs tomorrow. And we can import and export freely, which is, you know, what we would advocate for. But certainly, you know, Trump makes the case that he's going to get the Chinese to pay for all these imports. It's not. It's American consumers that are going to pay. And once that dawns on them, then they'll realize that all their goods they're paying for are more expensive.
Neil Emmerich is with the Free Market Foundation. Fascinating insights there on the Freedom Index, and nice good news to hear that South Africa's moved a little up. And we close off our last interview with a little bit more good news, and this is from an absolutely fascinating discussion that my colleague Bronwyn Nielsen had over the weekend with Michael Jordaan. Now, Michael Jordaan is well known as being the man at the helm when FNB was the most innovative bank in the world, and that's official. And he has, subsequent to that, being the CEO of FNB, he went into banking with a company called Bank Zero, and has been very involved in a disruptor on the data side in South Africa called Rain. And Rain is doing particularly well. But here's Michael on his view about South Africa into the future.
I have become far more positive about the next decade than the past decade. I do think generally we can be a little bit tough on ourselves. I'd like to think that it's perfectly possible and feasible that South Africa will grow at about 2.9% for the next decade. Now, if we do that, it's still not enough. It needs to be 4 or 5 or 6% to make big dents in unemployment, but it'll be significantly better than in the last decade, and we will be creating some jobs at least.
What underpins that positivity, Michael?
Well, first of all, you can rely on other people to do all the hard work and studies. Now, there's a particularly interesting analysis of global growth, or at least the top 20 economies in the globe, that was done by Ray Dalio, a famous hedge fund manager, someone who's done incredibly well for the people who've invested with him, but himself as well, by doing deep, deep research, understanding historical precedents. And he recently released a report that takes account more than 80 indicators in each of these countries and then compares the growth for the next decade. Now, they're the usual suspects there. India will do very well, as will do Indonesia. Interestingly, so will the UAE and Saudi Arabia. But pretty close to the top is South Africa at 2.9% for the next decade. What's also interesting out of his analysis is how the US and the UK will struggle at just over 1%, and that most of Europe will actually be at zero or even in negative territory. So the world is going to change quite dramatically in the future. Emerging markets are definitely going to outperform developed markets, and South Africa is an emerging market after all. Now, clearly, I wish we could take, you know, more of the tough decisions to grow at a higher rate, but most South Africans out there will be pretty happy if we can do 2.9% on average for the next decade. It's going to be a good place to be.
What he didn't give you was the context of the last decade, where we've barely grew at all. In fact, South Africa's GDP, or gross domestic product, rose by less than the population growth rate of 1.6% a year. And what that means is that we're getting poorer as a nation, as individuals, relative to the rest of the world. But with the government of national unity and what Michael is mentioning there, there will be challenges for the country into the future. We come from a basis of some pretty weird economic policy. And it's funny, the definition of insanity that Albert Einstein used, of doing the same thing and expecting a different result, is very deeply embedded when it comes to economic policy in South Africa. We have a group of people who've implemented ideas here that have been bankrupting countries around the world on a very continuous basis. And one hopes that with the government of national unity, different ideas will start flowing. How that's going to happen, though, is going to be over time. We're going to see lots of fights, like is the one looming in the Department of Agriculture that Piet Leroux of AfriForum explained to us earlier today. And there's no doubt that we're in for a very interesting ride on a geopolitical area, as South Africa and its partners in BRICS now include Iran, almost Saudi Arabia. They're on the verges of coming into the BRICS unit. Of course, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and Egypt is in there as well, as is Ethiopia. So it's an interesting time to be living in the world, to be looking at geopolitics, as it does affect everything that goes on, from our own politics in South Africa to the creation of jobs to economics. And one hopes that those who think they know will at least open their minds and realize that the performances that have been achieved in the past, or lack of it, have got roots in some pretty crazy ideas. Rather get rid of those ideas. Let's bring in the right type of ideas. And at BizNews, we keep airing those so that, well, maybe somewhere the penny will drop. This is the Biz News Briefing. I'm Alec Hogg. It's been a pleasure to be with you for an hour of power this morning. And we're going to close off with a quip from Neil de Beer, a tailpiece, if you like. This is from his conversation with my colleague, Chris Stain.
Neil, let's quickly go to the defections and the high-profile departures from the Economic Freedom Front. Where did Commander-in-Chief Julius Malema lose the plot?
The day he was born. I think what we need to... Sorry.
sorry as well. Well, that's Neil de Beer's view on... and I can tell you that the whole of that conversation does give you his straight shooting approach. I strongly recommend that you go and pick it up, as well as the other issues that you can pick up or find from the Biz News, the various Biz News channels on YouTube, Biz News Radio. And if you are hearing the Biz News Briefing live for the first time, or a recording of this, you can join us every morning at 7 a.m. Just go to biznews.com. It's right across the front page. Click on the image there and you'll be with us live. Until tomorrow, cheerio.